Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you have something to say and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details or contact us at pr@speakuptalkradio.com. Well, right now, I have an author who says he loves naps, and I just hope he's not taking one right now. He is Alan Batchelder. A native of Seattle, Washington, Alan earned his undergraduate degree in acting at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, which was recently declared to be the best college theater program in the country by OnStage. Alan then earned his Master's of Fine Arts in Acting from the now-defunct National Theater Conservatory in Denver, Colorado. Almost immediately after earning membership in Actors Equity Association, he and his wife bought a house and decided to have a family, which brought a temporary end to his stage career. For the past 25 years, Alan has been teaching in schools, public and private, during which time he earned his second Master's in Teaching. And to keep his creative juices flowing, Alan worked for 9 years as a stand-up comedian, which led to stints writing comic dialogue for computer games and sentiments for greeting cards. Through all of this, Alan wrote some more, beginning with monologues, then plays, then screenplays, and finally the books we're discussing today. In his dream world, he'd like to spend his twilight years writing, acting, and perhaps painting or learning an instrument. I know that I'm excited to bring him on today because we have lots to talk about. So welcome to the network, Alan.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Tell us a bit about your professional acting career, as I suspect it somewhat bleeds into who you are as a writer.
I thought I always wanted to be an actor from about eighth grade, and I pursued it pretty hard. I didn't take any detours or, you know, try any other paths. I went straight to college, got my degree, and then focused on getting into graduate school. And all the time, I was doing as many plays as I could possibly fit into one schedule. In fact, I think in 1 year of college, I did 9 plays.
Whoa.
Yeah, that was a lot. And I took acting internships around the country. So I got to travel quite a bit. I got to the East Coast and the South and the Midwest and the West Coast. And that was one of the great things about being young and in the theater was I really got to see the country that I live in. And after I got my graduate degree, I joined the union and I did a number of shows. But I met my wife and we decided, as I said in my bio, to get a home and have a family. And it's hard to support that. As an actor. Mm-hmm. So I was offered a teaching job and I started directing plays with the kids and I just fell in love with that, you know. So I haven't really looked back, but I am hoping I'll get to a point where I can get back on stage. I do commercials. I've done a few commercials and I have a YouTube channel of my commercials, but I really love Shakespeare, and that pops up throughout my books. And that's what I'd love to do the most if I was given my druthers. Go back on stage and just do Shakespeare play after Shakespeare play.
Well, let's hope that dream comes true for you. Now, your website teases Journey to a World that would make Beowulf cower in fear and Conan run home to his mommy, a world of century-old mysteries and grievances and mad gods that only the Great Reaper can hope to keep in check. Well, that's quite a grabber, huh?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, I read all of Conan the Barbarian before I actually got around to Lord of the Rings and John Carter of Mars. And then when you study theater, you learn a lot more about Odysseus and you learn a lot more about Beowulf and sort of classic literature that's often developed into stage plays. And so I think if you go to my website, immortaltreachery.com, there's a slideshow of all the different characters that are sort of inspirations for Vikers. Anybody from Bruce Lee to Clint Eastwood to Shiro Mifune's Yojimbo character to to Conan the Barbarian or Beowulf. And I just wanted to have my own stab at that kind of a character.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you give us an overview of your series? You have 4 books out now, right?
Right, and I'm working on the 5th, which is the finale for this particular series.
Right.
So the first book is a standalone. It doesn't require that you read any further. But I was really inspired by Steven Erikson's Malazan Book of the Fallen series in this regard. When you pick up the first book in his series, it starts right in the middle of the action with no explanation, no exposition, no backstory, and you're not spoon-fed. You actually have to think. You have to have patience. You have to hang with the story for a while. So I wanted to do that with my character, Tarman Viker, and my story starts right in the middle of the action, and it rapidly puts him at the lowest point imaginable, and you wonder to yourself, well, how is he possibly going to go anywhere from this? I don't want to give it away, but he's pretty much destroyed at the beginning of the first book, and then he builds his way back to this unstoppable killing machine that he is. I also am really inspired by the ambiguity of a lot of modern writing. You see that in Game of Thrones, even on a show like House, you know, with Dr. House, there's a sort of moral ambiguity that is really appealing to me. And I'm an older person now than I was when I read The Lord of the Rings. I'm middle-aged, and I have a better appreciation for ambiguity than I used to. But anyway, back to your question. So we have this unstoppable, legendary killing machine, but he's shrouded in mystery, and a lot of it even he doesn't understand. There's no book, there's no map for this series. And that's been one of the minor quibbles that some folks have had, but I tell them that it's entirely story-based, and by the time you get to the end of the 5th novel, you understand completely why there is no map. I actually love maps. I've drawn a few maps of my own, and I have a lot of fun with it. But in this case, there's a concrete reason for there not being a map. So I think that I'm emulating in some ways. I'm hoping I'm emulating Steven Erikson in that regard, that I'm asking people to think a bit more, to have a little bit more patience, and hopefully I'm able to give them the payoff that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of myself as a writer to think, would I be able to start right in the middle of the action? And I think my answer would be no. So I'm imagining it would take a little bit of effort to just jump in and, as you say, hope that people hang in there for that. I like it.
Well, it does take a certain amount of, I don't even, my vocabulary is failing me here. I don't want to say it's courage, mm-hmm. and I don't want to say it's apathy, that I don't care what the reader thinks. But, I mean, this is who I aspire to be mm-hmm. As a writer. And I think if you were to meet me in person today, you'd be joining my story in progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you would have missed 55 years of, you know, pratfalls and failures and
right.
some triumphs and, you know, amusing anecdotes. But there's more to come, and it's part of a larger picture.
Mm-hmm. That makes me think a lot, and I don't want to spend the whole time talking about that, but that's a whole different conversation we can have maybe some other time. Let's talk about Vikers. Who is he, and where did he come from?
Well, that is the central question of the whole series, and people have been getting little puzzle pieces throughout the first 4 novels, and I think that's one of the reasons that the reviews and the ratings have remained high, is that I'm somehow managing to feed people those little puzzle pieces as they go. But what you learn from the very beginning is that he's had this long-standing, almost impossibly long-standing reputation as someone who's achieved impossible feats, you know, that he's defeated armies by himself, which is a ludicrous notion in and of itself. Until you begin to learn more about him and find out who he is and what his abilities are, At the same time, he's kind of a free agent in the world. He doesn't want to be drafted, you know, for the cause of good necessarily. And he doesn't have much patience for villains. He just, in a way, and I suppose he's not even aware of it, in a way he is on a quest to figure out who he is. Mm-hmm. And maybe I've taken a part of that from Clint Eastwood's Man with No Name. We don't really know a lot about the Man with No Name, except that he's the best in the world at what he does. And his morals, again, are kind of ambiguous. He does things that, you know, you and I would disapprove of, but then every once in a while he'll do something that seems to redeem him. So I wanted to write someone who's kind of up there with Beowulf or Odysseus or Conan the Barbarian, that you might consider in the same sort of breath. But I can't give you too many spoilers because the central mystery of the entire five book series is who is he and where does he come from?
Okay. All right. I thought I'd sneak that question in, but you caught me. Let's talk about a few of your other characters and share how they came about and how they developed.
So I really wanted to write some strong female characters. I have three sisters. And obviously I had a mother and I have a wife. And so I wanted to write, and as a teacher too, I wanted to write some characters that maybe would speak more to the concerns of women. And I wanted them to be as strong as my sisters or strong as my mother or my wife. I didn't want sort of simpering stereotypes that have to be rescued by the male character. By the male protagonist. So I've written a whole range of them. There's a giantess named Mardine. There's a character at the very beginning called Aoife, and she runs all the way through the five books. And she undergoes an astounding metamorphosis over the course of the books. But she's going to inevitably become potentially the most powerful person in all the books. And then there's a very old virgin queen, sort of modeled on Queen Elizabeth, who is very powerful in her own right, who doesn't take any guff from anybody. She's the boss in her world, and nobody dares to contradict her. And there are more. So female characters, so I did make a conscientious effort in that regard. Mm-hmm. And I guess in some ways it's a tribute to the various women in my life. Then there are other characters. There's a sort of a village idiot character, but I wasn't trying to make a values statement about the mentally handicapped or anything. It's just that this particular character is clueless on an epic level. Mm-hmm. And yet he comes into quite a bit of power on his own. And then there's a central character called Long Pete, who has a very unpredictable path and a very unexpected result. And I wanted him to just sort of be the everyman. Mm-hmm. who walks through this whole story. In terms of non-human creatures, I didn't want to do sort of the elves and the orcs and the dwarves and the dragons that are so common in a lot of the genre. And again, I could look to someone like Steven Erikson, whose races are non-traditional. You might recognize them perhaps as iterations of orcs and elves and all that, but I wanted my own world with my own creatures and my own races. I think that's nice because you don't have to adhere to a cliche. You're not bound by a cliche. You don't have to pay homage to it. And in fact, there are no dragons in the whole five-book series, although in the recent novel I did offer up a tremendous monster that I think people will appreciate. So Have I answered that question?
Yes, you have. You have. And as you were speaking, I was thinking of the names that you came up with, Long Pete. How did you come up with the character names?
You know, it's a strange thing. They just sort of pop into my head. And occasionally I've had to change a couple of them. I had to change Rem because originally his name was something else that was similar to another character. But often, and Rem, of course, is the actor. So there's a lot of theater jokes wrapped up in what's happening with Remuel Ratch is his full name. Mm. And he sort of mimics the experience of an Elizabethan actor. But anyway, they just kind of pop into my head, and I don't know what their origin is.
Interesting. Well, you don't need to. I thought I'd ask that question because they are interesting names. What about your battle scenes?
I remember when I was 12, I think. So I have four siblings, and for some reason, my dad chose to take me down to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and leave the other four siblings at home. This was the 70s when you could do things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to see Henry V at the outdoor theater there. And I was expecting it to be this opera-like experience. In other words, long and tedious for a 12-year-old boy.
Sure.
But it was fantastic. We sat in like the second or third row in the center, and Powers Booth was playing Henry V. They put this substance on the swords. I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but they sparked and flared whenever the swords clashed. And there was cannon fire, and there was blood, and there was body humor, and there were tremendous, great, uplifting speeches. And so I sort of started to get into that aspect of it as a young boy, and then reading The Lord of the Rings, and then watching a lot of Kurosawa films. I think my dad took me to The Seven Samurai when I was pretty young. And again, there are authors out there who do this very well. Stephen Erickson's famous for ending his novels with gigantic, sprawling conflicts, and Joe Abercrombie's another one who writes pretty great battle scenes. In fact, he's got a character called the Bloody Nine, who has a lot of similarities, I think, with Tyrion Vickers. So I really wanted the battle scenes to kind of cap off the story in a sensational, rousing way. But not all battles are the same. So the one at the end of the first book has its own character, and then there's a different one at the end of the third book that's quite a bit different. And then at the end of the fourth book, there's a different thing. So I didn't want to write the same battle over and over. Mm-hmm. But I will say that the battle at the end of Steel, Blood, and Fire, which is the first book in the series, is loosely based on the Battle of Agincourt at the end of Henry V,
mm-hmm.
the historical battle. So there's some of that worked into the story.
It's interesting that your dad takes you to this outdoor theater and it just sparks something in you. And so swords are important in your books as well.
Yes, yes. And that's another thing. You know, there are certain archetypes in these stories having to do with swords or elves or dragons or whatever it is. And I've really enjoyed putting some of those things on their head every once in a while. So that, you know, as far as Vickers is concerned in the beginning, there's no such thing as a magic sword. And, you know, he's heard all about them, but they've always turned out to be bogus. And when he does finally encounter one, it's nothing special to look at. It's not, you know, shimmering black etched with magical runes or anything. It's just a sword from his perspective. But it becomes something other over the course of the story. Yeah, so I'm having fun playing with some of those tropes and some of those archetypes and kind of trying to put my own spin on them, which I hope and I assume is what most writers do.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there's so much going on in your head and that you want to get on the paper. How do you know then when your books are done?
Well, I have... particularly for the first one, I had a vision for the opening scene, if you will. And this kind of relates to my theater background. I had a vision for the opening scene and a vision for the final scene. and then even a vision for the final of the whole series. I had all that at the beginning. So I would start at point A and begin telling the story. I watched an interview with Lois Lowry once, the woman who wrote The Giver, and she talked about two kinds of writers, the plotters and the planners, mm-hmm. or the planners and the pantsers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm a pantser. I she describes J.K. Rowling as a plotter. I'm not that way. I know what the beginning is. I know what the end is. I know what some of the benchmarks are going to be along the way, but some of my favorite things just sort of pop into my head. For instance, in book two, there's this epic mistaken identity, episode of mistaken identity, and that just happened spontaneously, and I went with it. I learned early on, I was taking a playwriting class, and I learned early on that you can't sort of force your characters in your plot to fall into line. You know, there has to be a certain organic mm-hmm. aspect to it, because the characters want to say what they want to say, not necessarily what you want them to say. And I think that gives them a more authentic voice. Mm-hmm. So you have to allow a little room for subconscious inspiration. And I guess I should say too that there is a fair amount of dialogue in the first book in particular, because I came from a place of dialogue, from the theater and from writing screenplays. And it's something that I hear particularly well. I'm sure that I have, you know, weaknesses, like many authors do, that could use a bit more polish and refinement. But at the beginning, I think you start with your strength and work from there.
Right. As you were speaking about your characters, I was thinking of children. The characters are almost like children. As they grow up, they have their own ideas and they want to become who they are. And how can you fit them into the mold that you want them to fit? So interesting thought when you think about character development.
Well, I love what you just said about fitting them into the mold that you want them to fit into. I think that if you can stand it, if you can bear it, you should actually let them deviate from your mold.
Mm-hmm.
Let them create their own mold,
right.
Find their own place for where they want to be. And sometimes that means, you know, that you a character that you love dies, or a character that you love might become irrelevant to the story. But I think it's a risk you have to take if you want a more authentic voice.
No, I agree. It's a very personal experience, like I say, almost like raising a child. We haven't mentioned the titles of your books. Let's give those. And is it easy or is it difficult to title your books?
Well, you know, again, like everything else, I did this in my own way. And I know that, you know, a professional editor or publisher would tell me, you know, all of the titles have to have a similar flavor and a similar theme, so that one is yesterday and another one's today and another one's tomorrow.
Mm.
And I didn't do that. I sort of took the titles from within the action. The first one is a line of dialogue. And of course, after I name it, I look online and I see there are some similarly named works. But it's really Steel, Blood, and Fire is really the essence of what Vikers is about. And then the next one is a quote of dialogue, but it's also a line from King Lear by Shakespeare, which brings me to another point, and that is that my books are full of Easter eggs, the kind of Easter eggs you might find in computer games, or you might find in, you know, your favorite TV shows or Marvel superhero movies. They're full of Easter eggs, and people rarely mention them, but and which I find kind of astounding. And by Easter egg, I mean there might be a tiny line from Lewis Carroll or a brief reference to Edgar Allan Poe or a quote from Shakespeare. And I usually choose works that are in the public domain so I don't get sued.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but they're chock full of these literary references or allusions, and nobody ever mentions that.
Interesting.
It's a strange thing to me.
What are you thinking is the reason?
Well, I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. I've had people who are close to me say, oh, yeah, I caught that one. But there's more than one. There's probably 10 or 12 in each book. And if you're, so if you're someone who likes to read those works, I think these would appeal to you just trying to find them all.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in fact, I've offered a reward in the past on various forums to anyone who can find them all. What were we were talking
the
about?
The titles of the books.
Oh, the titles, yes, yes, yes. And so the third one, Corpse Cold, comes from an experience that various people are having in book three. And I really struggled with the title for book four because I wanted to have call it The Ruined God. But, of course, there's a major international bestseller that just came out called A God in Ruins.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't want to look like I was writing her coattails or trying to steal her ideas. So I sort of crafted that one. The last title is going to throw everyone for a loop and give them a huge misimpression, which I like because it will be very, very funny when people find out why it's called that. The last book is called The End of All Things, and that's a character who appears in the first book. He's actually the villain of the first book, and he's referred to periodically throughout the other books. But when people see that title, they're going to say, oh, no, not again. But it's actually something entirely different. I mean, I thought about calling it Twilight of the Gods as a play on Wagner's Ring series.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't like the Twilight aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that with a lot of people, not everyone, and I don't mean to be a snob, but a lot of people are not fans of the Twilight series. And so I couldn't use Twilight of the Gods.
That's interesting that you have to really think about it and cater to potential audiences and potential readers. And with that in mind, what are your expectations from your readers? What are you hoping?
I hope that they're patient. I hope that they read the books more than once if they enjoy them. I hope that they read other books in the genre. So there's a newish genre. I can't tell you exactly when it came into being, but it's called grimdark, one word, grimdark. And it sort of describes Game of Thrones, or if you've watched the television series Vikings, or again, the works of Joe Abercrombie, for example. It's very dark, brutal fantasy. And I kind of aspire to that genre. I'd like to belong to that genre. I have one limitation, and that is that currently I'm a middle school teacher,
mm-hmm.
and so I don't want the parents of my children to think I'm a sociopath.
No.
So I have to scale back the language and the violence a bit, you know, on the off chance that my students come across these books.
Right.
But I'm engaged in a few debates online and in various forums on the subject about the necessity of sex and or violence in some of these books. And people often bring up Tolkien as the gold standard for fantasy. And I would say that's true, but I would also say we live in a different era now.
Mm-hmm.
We live in an era where I think we are more conscious of ambiguity, and to me, that just the image of elves, you know, skipping around in the field, tossing flowers into the air, was not what I wanted from fantasy as a middle-aged man.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted something that was more reflective of the world I live in, which is a strange thing to say for someone who loves fantasy. But my suspension of disbelief will only go so far. And when all of the protagonists are unbearably sweet and kind and honest and good,
mm-hmm.
and all of the antagonists are, you know, unspeakably vile and loathsome, and yet never use profanity or engage in sex, I think that's a little too much to ask for me anyway, right. as the reader.
No, I get it. Yeah, and you do have to be a little wary considering that your students look up to you, I'm sure.
Right. So they're all very, very curious about the book. Mm-hmm. So I intentionally put the age limit at 17 on Amazon, and my students are all, you know, 13 and 14.
Right.
So, and I've had chats with a few parents who are intrigued about it, but I say I don't recommend this for your kid. And at the same time, a lot of these parents allow their kids to watch Game of Thrones. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that's something you can't control, but you can control how you put yourself forward to your students.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, mm-hmm. and you know, there may be a day, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, when I can just write, no holds barred and put whatever I want on the page and let an editor worry about it.
Right. Got it. Wow, this has gone by a little too quickly for me. I just have so much more I wanted to talk with you about, and I wanted to get into your writing process. But I'm glad that we really spent a lot of time on your books and how they came out of you and to be what they are now. In wrapping up then, is there anything that we missed that you want to bring up?
I didn't really talk about the writing process, but I mean, maybe that's something for another time. And certainly more successful and famous authors than I have put their writing process out there on the internet. Mm-hmm. So you can find out Stephen King's exact schedule every day, which is inspiring to me.
Right, right. Well, yes. We can, though, ask you to give any final words of advice that you might have to authors and aspiring writers.
Well, this is what I tell my friends and my siblings. It's right. I put it off for years and years because I wasn't sure that I had them in what constitutes a paragraph. But you only get one life, and you don't gain anything by not trying, but by trying. You have thousands of readers. And it's just wonderful. It's this great community of people I've never met from all over the world, actually, who support me and are into my vision. And that's just such a rejuvenating and a self-reinforcing experience. I love it. And so that's it. I would write. Start with a sentence, expand to a paragraph, and keep going.
Not to be afraid, just get out there and do it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Because what's the worst that can happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not as if people are going to reach out and slap you or attack your financial basis or anything like that. If you're a terrible writer, you simply won't be read. And there are worse things that could happen to a person.
Very true. And a lot of writing, I think, is just so cathartic, whether people read it or not, just to get it out of you and get it on paper. Get out there and write and put it out there and see what happens. Well, where can folks go then to learn more about you, and where can they purchase your books?
Well, I have Twitter at Tarmon Vikers, and I have a website, www.immortaltreachery.com, and I'm on Facebook at Steel Blood Fire. I have an Instagram. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head. I have some great, great support from bestfantasybooks.com. They really helped launch me in a big way. I was wallowing in obscurity, and then they got addicted to my books, and it sort of caught fire over there. And I can't say enough about the nice folks over there. So if you drop by bestfantasybooks.com and just enter my name in the search bar, you'll get 10 zillion hits and all kinds of topics and an interview, and it's been great fun.
Give us your website again.
My website is immortaltreachery.com. That's the name of the whole series.
Right. All righty. So we're going to send folks over to immortaltreachery.com to learn more about you and your books. And I think you gave us just a nice peek into you. So I hope folks head over to immortaltreachery.com. Alan, thank you for today. I was looking forward to this, and you did not disappoint.
Well, thank you, Pat. I loved it.